The initial research showing an effect of diet on MS goes back more than half a century to the research of Dr. Roy Swank, who began his work in Norway and at the Montreal Neurological Institute during the 1940s. Later, Dr. Swank headed the Division of Neurology at the University of Oregon Medical School. Dr. Swank became interested in the dietary connection when he learned that MS appeared to be more common in the northern climates. There is a huge difference in MS prevalence as one moves away from the equator. MS is over 100 times more prevalent in the far north than at the equator, and 7 times more prevalent in South Australia, closer to the South Pole, than in North Australia. This distribution is very similar to the distribution of other autoimmune diseases, including type 1 diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis. Although some scientists speculated that magnetic fields might be responsible for the disease, Dr. Swank thought it was diet, especially animal-based foods high in saturated fats. He found that inland dairy-consuming areas of Norway had higher rates of MS than coastal fish-consuming areas. Swank conducted his best-known trial on 144 MS patients recruited from the Montreal Neurological Institute. He kept records on these patients for the next 34 years. He advised his patients to consume a diet low in saturated fat, most of whom did, but many of whom did not. He then classified them as good dieters or poor dieters, based on whether they consumed less or more than 20 grams a day of saturated fat. For comparison, a bacon cheeseburger with condiments has about 16 grams of saturated fat. One small frozen chicken pot pie has almost 10 grams of saturated fat. As the study continued, Dr. Swank found that progression of disease was greatly reduced by the low saturated fat diet, which worked even for people with initially advanced conditions. He summarized his work in 1990, concluding that for the subgroup of patients who began the low saturated fat diet during the earlier stages of their disease, about 95% remained only mildly disabled for approximately 30 years. Only 5% of these patients died. In contrast, 80% of the patients with early-stage MS who consumed the poor diet, higher saturated fat, died of MS. The results from all 144 patients, including those who started the diet at a later stage of disease, are shown in Chart 9.4. This work is remarkable. To follow people for 34 years is an exceptional demonstration of perseverance and dedication. Moreover, if this were a study testing a potential drug, these findings would make any pharmaceutical manufacturer jingle the coins in his or her pocket. Swank's first results were published more than a half century ago, then again, and again, and again, for the next 40 years. Additional studies have confirmed and extended Swank's observations, and gradually have begun to place more emphasis on cow's milk. These new studies show that consuming cow's milk is strongly linked to MS, both when comparing different countries and when comparing states within the U.S. Chart 9.5, published by French researchers, compares the consumption of cow's milk with MS for 26 populations in 24 countries. This relationship, which is virtually identical to that for type 1 diabetes, is remarkable, and it is not due to variables such as the availability of medical services or geographic latitude. In some studies, researchers suggest this strong correlation with fresh cow's milk might be due to the presence of a virus in the milk. These more recent studies also suggest that saturated fat alone probably was not responsible for Swank's results. The consumption of meat high in saturated fat, like milk, was also associated with MS in these multi-country studies, while the consumption of fish containing more omega-3 fat was associated with low rates of disease. The association of cow's milk with MS, shown in Chart 9.5, may be impressive, but it does not constitute proof. For example, where do genes and viruses come into play? Either of these, in theory, might account for the unusual geographic distribution of this disease. In the case of viruses, no definite conclusions are yet possible. A variety of different virus types have been suggested, and a variety of effects on the immune system may be involved. However, nothing very convincing has been proven. Some of the evidence is based on finding more viral antibodies in MS patients than in controls. Some is based on sporadic outbreaks of MS among isolated communities, and some is based on finding virus-like genes among MS cases. With regard to genes, we can begin to puzzle out their association with MS by asking the usual question. What happens to people who migrate from one population to another, keeping their genes the same but changing their diets and their environment? The answer is the same as it was for cancer, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes. People acquire the risk of the population to which they move, especially if they move before their adolescent years. This tells us that this disease is more strongly related to environmental factors than it is to genes. Specific genes have been identified as possible candidates for causing MS, but according to a 2001 report, as many as 25 genes may be playing such a role. Therefore, it will undoubtedly be a long time before we determine with any precision which genes or combinations of genes predispose someone to MS. Genetic predisposition may make a difference as to who gets MS, but even at best, genes can only account for about one-fourth of the total disease risk. Although MS and type 1 diabetes share some of the same unanswered questions on the exact roles of viruses and genes and the immune system, they also share the same alarming evidence regarding diet. For both diseases, a Western diet is strongly associated with disease incidence. Not all studies show that a healthy diet leads to disease improvement. A small one-year trial of a plant-based diet showed no significant benefit in short-term MS symptoms or disability, although there were improvements in the subject's metabolic health. This illustrates the principle that because a Western diet is so strongly disease-promoting for metabolic conditions and certain cancers, it seems that there is more than enough evidence to prescribe a whole foods, plant-based diet for both the prevention and treatment of these conditions. The commonality of autoimmune diseases. What about other autoimmune diseases? There are dozens of autoimmune diseases, and I have mentioned only two of the more prominent ones. Can we say anything about them as a whole? To answer this question, we need to identify how much these diseases have in common. The more they have in common, the greater the probability that they also will share a common cause or causes. This is like seeing two people you don't know, both of whom have a similar body type, hair color, eye color, facial features, physical and vocal mannerisms, and age, and concluding that they come from the same parents. Just as we hypothesized that diseases of affluence such as cancer and heart disease have common causes because they share similar geography and similar biochemical biomarkers, see Chapter 4, we can also hypothesize that MS, type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and other autoimmune diseases may share a similar cause if they exhibit similar characteristics. First, by definition, each of these diseases involves an immune system that has gone awry in such a way that it attacks self-proteins that look the same as foreign proteins. Second, all the autoimmune diseases that have been studied have been found to be more common at the higher geographic latitudes, where there is less constant sunshine. Third, some of these diseases have a tendency to afflict the same people. MS and type 1 diabetes, for example, have been shown to coexist in the same individuals. Parkinson's disease, a non-autoimmune disease with autoimmune characteristics, is often found with MS, both within the same geographic regions and within the same individuals. MS also has been associated, either geographically or within the same individuals, with other autoimmune diseases like lupus, myasthenia gravis, Graves' disease, and eosinophilic vasculitis. Juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, another autoimmune disease, has been shown to have an unusually strong association with Hashimoto thyroiditis. Fourth, of those diseases studied in relation to nutrition, the consumption of animal-based foods, especially cow's milk, is associated with greater disease risk. Fifth, there is evidence that a virus or viruses may trigger the onset of several of these diseases. A sixth and most important characteristic binding together these diseases is the evidence that their mechanisms of action, jargon used to describe the how-to of disease formation, have much in common. As we consider common mechanisms of action, we might start with sunlight exposure, because this somehow seems linked to the autoimmune diseases. Sunlight exposure, which decreases with increasing latitude, could be important, but clearly there are other factors. The consumption of animal-based foods, especially cow's milk, also increases with distance from the equator. In fact, in one of the more extensive studies, cow's milk was found to be as good of a predictor of MS as latitude, i.e. sunshine. In Dr. Swank's studies in Norway, MS was less common near the coastal areas of the country where fish intake was more common. This gave rise to the idea that the omega-3 fats common to fish might have a protective effect. What is almost never mentioned, however, is that dairy consumption and saturated fat was much lower in the fish-eating areas. Is it possible that cow's milk and lack of sunshine are having a similar effect on MS and other autoimmune diseases because they operate through a similar mechanism? This could be very interesting if true. As it turns out, the idea is not so crazy. This mechanism involves, once again, vitamin D. There are experimental animal models of lupus, MS, rheumatoid arthritis, and inflammatory bowel disease, for example, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, each of which is an autoimmune disease. Vitamin D, operating through a similar mechanism in each case, prevents the experimental development of each of these diseases. This becomes an even more intriguing story when we think about the effect of food on vitamin D. The first step in the vitamin D process occurs when you go outside on a sunny day. When the sunshine hits your exposed skin, the skin produces vitamin D. The vitamin D then must be activated in the kidney in order to produce a form that helps repress the development of autoimmune diseases. As we've seen before, this critically important activation step can be inhibited by foods that are high in calcium and by acid-producing animal proteins like cow's milk. Some grains also produce excess acid. Under experimental conditions, the activated vitamin D operates in two ways. It inhibits the development of certain T cells and their production of active agents, called cytokines, that initiate the autoimmune response, and or it encourages the production of other T cells that oppose this effect. An abbreviated schematic of this vitamin D network is shown in Appendix C. This mechanism of action appears to be a strong commonality among all autoimmune diseases so far studied. Knowing the strength of the evidence against animal foods, cow's milk in particular, for both MS and type 1 diabetes, and knowing how much in common all of the autoimmune diseases have, it is reasonable to begin thinking about food and its relationship to a much broader group of autoimmune diseases. Obviously, caution is called for. More research is needed to make conclusive statements about cross-autoimmune disease similarities, but the evidence we have now is already striking. Today, almost no indication of the dietary connection to these diseases has reached public awareness. In 2003, the website of the Multiple Sclerosis International Federation, for example, stated, "There is no credible evidence that MS is due to poor diet or dietary deficiencies." They warned that dietary regimens can be expensive and can alter the normal nutritional balance. If changing your diet is expensive, I don't know what they would say about being bedridden and incapacitated. As far as altering the normal nutritional balance is concerned, what is normal? Does this mean the diet that we now eat is normal? The diet that is largely responsible for diseases that disable, kill, and make profoundly miserable millions of Americans every year? Are massive rates of heart disease, cancer, autoimmune diseases, obesity, and diabetes normal? If this is normal, I propose we start seriously considering the abnormal. The present Multiple Sclerosis International Federation website does not include this provocative and irresponsible quote, but they still speculate about causes of MS as possibly being due to environmental and genetic factors, with nary a word about diet. They mention a role for the immune system, MS's inverse relationship with vitamin D, and that MS is not simply a genetic disease, but avoid mentioning that nutrition could account for all three of these observations. Is this progress? I don't think so. There are 400,000 Americans who are victims of multiple sclerosis, and millions more with other autoimmune diseases. While statistics, research results, and clinical descriptions form the basis for much of my discussion of diet and disease, the importance of the information comes down to the intimate experience of individual people. Any one of these serious diseases I've talked about in this chapter can forever alter the life of any person, a family member, a friend, a neighbor, a co-worker, or you yourself. It is time to sacrifice our sacred cows. Reason must prevail. Professional societies, doctors, and government agencies need to stand up and do their duty, so that children being born today do not face tragedies that otherwise could be prevented. Chapter 10. Wide-ranging effects. Bone, kidney, eye, and brain diseases. One of the most convincing arguments for a plant-based diet is the fact that it prevents a broad range of diseases. If I have a conversation with someone about a single study showing the protective effect of fruits and vegetables on heart disease, they may agree that it's all very nice for fruits and vegetables, but they will probably still go home to meatloaf and gravy. It doesn't matter how big the study, how persuasive the results, or how reputable the scientists who conducted the investigation. The fact is that most people have a healthy skepticism about one study standing alone, as well they should. But if I tell them about dozens and dozens of studies showing that the countries with low rates of heart disease consume low amounts of animal-based foods, and dozens of studies showing that individuals who eat more whole, plant-based foods get less heart disease, and I go on to document still more studies showing that a diet low in animal-based foods and high in unprocessed plant-based foods can slow or reverse heart disease, then people are more inclined to pay some attention. If I keep talking and go through this process, not only for heart disease, but also obesity, type 2 diabetes, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, multiple sclerosis, and other autoimmune diseases, it's quite possible that people may never eat meatloaf and gravy again. What has become so convincing about the effect of a diet on health is the breadth of the evidence. While a single study might be found to support almost any idea under the sun, what are the chances that hundreds, even thousands of different studies show a protective benefit of plant-based foods and/or harmful effects of animal-based foods for so many different diseases? We can't say it's due to coincidence, bad data, biased research, misinterpreted statistics, or playing with numbers. This has got to be the real deal. I have so far presented only a small sample of the breadth of evidence that supports plant-based diets. To show you just how broad this evidence is, I will cover five more seemingly unrelated diseases common in America: osteoporosis, kidney stones, blindness, cognitive dysfunction, and Alzheimer's disease. These disorders are not often fatal, and are frequently regarded as the inevitable consequences of aging. Therefore, we don't think it's unnatural when Grandpa gets blurry spots in his vision, can't remember the names of his friends, or needs a hip replacement operation. But, as we shall see, even these diseases have a dietary link. Osteoporosis. Did you ever have an elementary school teacher tell you that if you didn't have bones, you would just be a shapeless blob on the floor? Or maybe you learned about the human skeleton from that popular song, "The ankle bone is connected to the shin bone is connected to the knee bone," etc. At the same time in your life, you probably were told to drink milk to build strong bones and teeth. Because none of us want to be shapeless blobs, and because our celebrities have been paid to advertise milk's presumed benefits, we drink it. Milk is to bone health as bees are to honey. Americans consume more cow's milk and its products per person than most populations in the world. So Americans should have wonderfully strong bones, right? Unfortunately, not. A recent study showed that American women, aged 50 and older, have one of the highest rates of hip fractures in the world. The only countries with higher rates are in Europe and in the South Pacific, Australia and New Zealand, where they consume even more milk than the United States. What's going on? An excess rate of hip fractures is often used as a reliable indicator of osteoporosis, a bone disease that especially affects women after menopause. It is often claimed to be due to an inadequate intake of calcium. Therefore, health policy people often recommend higher calcium consumption. Dairy products are particularly rich in calcium, so the dairy industry eagerly supports efforts to boost calcium consumption. These efforts have something to do with why you were told to drink your milk for strong bones, the politics of which are discussed in Part 4. Something is amiss, though, because those countries that use the most cow's milk and its products also have the highest fracture rates and the worst bone health. One possible explanation is found in a report showing an impressively strong association between animal protein intake and bone fracture rate for women in different countries. Authored in 1992, by researchers at Yale University School of Medicine, the report summarized data on protein intake and fracture rates taken from 34 separate surveys in 16 countries that were published in 29 peer-reviewed research publications. All the subjects in these surveys were women 50 years and older. It found that a very impressive 70% of the fracture rate was attributable to the consumption of animal protein. These researchers explained that animal protein, unlike plant protein, increases the acid load in the body. An increased acid load means that our blood and tissues become more acidic. The body does not like this acidic environment and begins to fight it. In order to neutralize the acid, the body uses calcium, which acts as a very effective base. This calcium, however, must come from somewhere. It ends up being pulled from the bones, and the calcium loss weakens them, putting them at greater risk for fracture. We have had evidence for well over 100 years that animal protein decreases bone health. The explanation of animal protein causing excess metabolic acid, for example, was first suggested in the 1880s and was documented as long ago as 1920. We also have known that animal protein is more effective than plant protein at increasing the metabolic acid load in the body. When animal protein increases metabolic acid, the amount of calcium in the urine is increased. This effect has been established for over 80 years and has been studied in some detail since the 1970s. Summaries of these studies were published in 1974, 1981, and 1990. Each of these summaries clearly shows that the amount of animal protein consumed by many of us on a daily basis is capable of causing substantial increases in urinary calcium. Chart 10.1 is taken from the 1981 publication. Doubling protein intake, mostly animal-based, from 35 to 78 grams per day causes an alarming 50% increase in urinary calcium. This effect occurs well within the range of protein intake that most of us consume. Average American intake is around 70 to 100 grams per day. Incidentally, as mentioned in Chapter 4, a 6-month study funded by the Atkins Center found that those people who adopted the Atkins diet excreted 50% more calcium in their urine after 6 months on the diet. The initial observations on the association between animal protein consumption and bone fracture rates are very impressive, and now we have a plausible explanation as to how the association might work, a mechanism of action. Disease processes are rarely as simple as one mechanism does it all, but the work being done in this field makes a strong argument. A more recent study comes from the Department of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. Using 87 surveys in 33 countries, it compares the ratio of vegetable to animal protein consumption to the rate of bone fractures. See chart 10.2. A high ratio of vegetable to animal protein consumption was found to be impressively associated with a virtual disappearance of bone fractures. These studies are compelling for several reasons. They were published in leading research journals. The authors were careful in their analyses and interpretation of data. They included a large number of individual research reports, and the statistical significance of the association of animal protein with bone fracture rates is truly exceptional. They cannot be dismissed as just another couple of studies. The most recent study represents a summary of 87 separate surveys. The study of osteoporotic fractures research group at the University of California at San Francisco published yet another study of over 1,000 women aged 65 and up. Like the multi-country study, researchers characterized women's diets by the proportions of animal and plant protein. After 7 years of observations, the women with the highest ratio of animal protein to plant protein had 3.7 times more bone fractures than the women with the lowest ratio. Also, during this time, the women with the high ratio lost bone almost 4 times as fast as the women with the lowest ratio. Experimentally, this study is high quality because it compared protein consumption, bone loss, and broken bones for the same subjects. This 3.7-fold effect is substantial and is very important because the women with the lowest bone fracture rates still consumed, on average, about half of their total protein from animal sources. I can't help but wonder how much greater the difference might have been had they consumed not 50%, but 0 to 10% of their total protein from animal sources. In our rural China study, where the animal-to-plant ratio was about 10%, the fracture rate is only about 1/5 that of the U.S. Nigeria shows an animal-to-plant protein ratio only about 10% that of Germany, and the hip fracture incidence is lower by over 99%. These observations raise a serious question about the widely advertised claim that protein-rich dairy foods protect our bones. And yet we still are warned almost daily about our need for dairy foods to provide calcium for strong bones. An avalanche of commentary warns that most of us are not meeting our calcium requirements, especially pregnant and lactating women. This calcium bonanza, however, is not justified. In one study of 10 countries, a higher consumption of calcium was associated with a higher, not lower, risk of bone fracture. See chart 10.3. Much of the calcium intake shown in this chart, especially in high consumption countries, is due to dairy foods rather than calcium supplements or non-dairy food sources of calcium. Mark Hegsted, who produced the results in chart 10.3, was a longtime Harvard professor. He worked on the calcium issue beginning in the early 1950s, was a principal architect of the nation's first dietary guidelines in 1980, and in 1986 published this graph. Professor Hegsted believed that excessively high calcium intake over a long time impaired the body's ability to control how much calcium it uses and when. Under healthy conditions, the body uses an activated form of vitamin D, calcitriol, to adjust how much calcium it absorbs from food and how much it excretes and distributes to the bone. Calcitriol is considered a hormone. When more calcium is needed, it enhances calcium absorption and restricts calcium excretion. If too much calcium is consumed over a long period of time, the body may lose its ability to regulate calcitriol, permanently or temporarily disrupting the regulation of calcium absorption and excretion. Ruining the regulatory mechanism in this way is a recipe for osteoporosis in menopausal and postmenopausal women. Women at this stage of life must be able to enhance their utilization of calcium in a timely manner, especially if they continue to consume a diet high in animal protein. The fact that the body loses its ability to control finely tuned mechanisms when they are subjected to continuous abuse is a well-established phenomenon in biology. Given these findings, it seems perfectly plausible that animal protein and even calcium, when consumed at excessive levels, are capable of increasing the risk of osteoporosis. Dairy, unfortunately, is the only food that is rich in both of these nutrients. Hegsted, backed up by his exceptional experience in calcium research, said in his 1986 paper, "Hip fractures are more frequent in populations where dairy products are commonly consumed and calcium intakes are relatively high." Years later, the dairy industry still suggests that we should be consuming more of its products to build strong bones and teeth. The confusion, conflict, and controversy rampant in this area of research allow anybody to say just about anything. And of course, huge amounts of money are at stake as well. One of the most cited osteoporosis experts, one funded by the dairy industry, angrily wrote in a prominent editorial that the findings cited favoring a diet with a higher ratio of plant to animal protein could have been influenced to some extent by currents in the larger society. The currents he was referring to were the animal rights activists opposed to the use of dairy foods. Much of the debate regarding osteoporosis, whether it is conducted with integrity or otherwise, resides in the research concerning the details. As you shall see, the devil lurks in the details, the primary detail being that of bone mineral density, BMD. Many scientists have investigated how various diet and lifestyle factors affect BMD. BMD is a measure of bone density that is often used to diagnose bone health. If your bone density falls below a certain level, you may be diagnosed with osteoporosis. In practical terms, this means that if you have a low BMD, you are at a higher risk for a fracture. But there are some devilishly contradictory and confusing details in this great circus of osteoporosis research. To name a few, a high BMD increases the risk of osteoarthritis. A high BMD has been linked to a higher risk of breast cancer. Although high BMD is linked to both increased breast cancer risk and decreased osteoporotic risk, breast cancer and osteoporosis nonetheless cluster together in the same areas of the world and even in the same individuals. Rate of bone loss matters just as much as overall BMD. There are places where overall bone mass, bone mineral density, or bone mineral content measurements are lower than they are in Western countries. But the fracture rate also is lower, defying accepted logic of how we define big, strong bones. Being fat is linked to greater BMD, even though areas of the world that have higher rates of obesity also have higher rates of osteoporosis. Something is wrong with the idea that BMD is the only biomarker that matters in osteoporosis, and, by inference, indicates the kind of diet that would lower fracture rates. In contrast, an alternative but much better predictor of osteoporosis is the dietary ratio of animal to plant protein. The higher the ratio, the higher the risk of disease. And guess what? BMD is not significantly associated with this ratio. Clearly, the conventional recommendations regarding animal foods, dairy, and bone mineral density, which are influenced and advertised by the dairy industry, are besieged by serious doubts in the literature. Here is what I would recommend you do, based on the research, to minimize your risk of osteoporosis. Stay physically active. Take the stairs instead of the elevator. Go for walks, jogs, bicycle rides. Swim. Do yoga or aerobics every couple of days, and don't be afraid to buy barbells to use once in a while. Play a sport or join a social group that incorporates exercise. The possibilities are endless, and they can be fun. You'll feel better, and your bones will be much healthier for the effort. Eat a variety of whole plant foods, and avoid animal foods, including dairy. Plenty of calcium is available in a wide range of plant foods, including beans and leafy vegetables and most non-dairy milks. As long as you stay away from refined carbohydrates, like sugary cereals, candies, plain pastas, and white breads, you should have no problem with calcium deficiency. Keep your salt intake to a minimum. Avoid highly processed and packaged foods which contain excess salt. There is some evidence that excessive salt intake can be a problem. Kidneys. At the website of the UCLA Kidney Stone Treatment Center, you will discover that kidney stones may cause the following symptoms: nausea, vomiting, restlessness, trying to find comfortable position to ease the pain, dull pain, ill-defined lumbar abdominal intermittent pain, urgency, urge to empty the bladder, frequency, frequent urination, bloody urine with pain, gross hematuria, fever when complicated by infection, acute renal colic, severe colicky flank pain radiating to groin, scrotum, labia. Acute renal colic deserves some explanation. This agonizing symptom is the result of a crystallized stone trying to pass through the thin tube in your body, ureter, that transports urine from the kidney to the bladder. In describing the pain involved, the website states, "This is probably one of the worst pains humans experience. Those who have had it will never forget it." The severe pain of renal colic needs to be controlled by potent painkillers. Don't expect an aspirin to do the trick. Get yourself to a doctor or an emergency room. I don't know about you, but just thinking about these things gives me a shiver. Unfortunately, up to 15% of Americans, more men than women, will be diagnosed with having a kidney stone in their lifetime. There are several kinds of kidney stones. Although one is a genetically rare type and another is related to many urinary infections, the majority involve stones made of calcium and oxalate. These calcium oxalate stones are relatively common in developed countries and relatively rare in developing countries. Again, this illness falls into the same global patterns as all the other Western diseases. I first was made aware of the dietary connection with this disease at the Faculty of Medicine of the University of Toronto. I was invited to give a seminar on our China study findings, and while there, I met Professor W.G. Robertson from the Medical Research Council in Leeds, England. This chance encounter was extremely rewarding. Dr. Robertson, as I have come to learn, is one of the world's foremost experts on diet and kidney stones. Dr. Robertson's research group has investigated the relationship between food and kidney stones with great depth and breadth, both in theory and in practice. Their work began more than 30 years ago and continues to the present day. A search of the scientific publications authored or co-authored by Robertson shows at least 100 papers published since the mid-1960s. One of Robertson's charts, based on a 1968 to 1973 UK study, depicts a stunning relationship between animal protein consumption and the formation of kidney stones. See chart 10.4. The study shows that consuming animal protein at levels above 21 grams per person per day, slightly less than 1 ounce, on top of a background of protein from plants, is closely correlated with the formation of a high number of kidney stones. This is an impressive relationship. Few researchers have worked out the details of a research question more thoroughly than Robertson and his colleagues. They have developed a model for estimating the risk of stone formation with remarkable accuracy. Although they have identified 6 risk factors for kidney stones, animal protein consumption was the major culprit. Consumption of animal protein at levels commonly seen in affluent countries leads to the development of 4 of the 6 risk factors. Not only is animal protein linked to risk factors for future formation of stones, but it affects recurring stones as well. Robertson published findings showing that among the patients who had recurrent kidney stones, he was able to resolve their problem simply by shifting their diet away from animal protein foods. How does this work? When enough animal protein-containing foods are consumed, the concentrations of calcium and oxalate in the urine increase sharply, usually within hours. Chart 10.5 shows these impressive changes, published by Robertson's group. The individuals in this study consumed only 55 grams per day of land-based animal protein, to which was added another 34 grams per day of animal protein in the form of tuna fish. This amount of animal protein consumption is well within the levels most Americans regularly eat. Men consume around 90 to 100 grams of total protein per day, the majority of which comes from animal foods. Women consume about 70 to 90 grams per day. When the kidney is under a persistent long-term assault from increased calcium and oxalate in the urine, kidney stones may result. The following, excerpted from a 1987 review by Robertson, emphasizes the role of diet, especially foods containing animal proteins. Urolithiasis, kidney stone formation, is a worldwide problem which appears to be aggravated by the high dairy produce, highly energy-rich, and low-fiber diets consumed in most industrialized countries. Evidence points, in particular, to a high meat protein intake as being the dominant factor. On the basis of epidemiological and biochemical studies, a move toward a more vegetarian, less energy-rich diet would be predicted to reduce the risk of stone in the population. A substantial and convincing effect on stone formation has been demonstrated for animal-based foods. Research also shows that kidney stone formation can be initiated by the activity of free radicals, and may thus be prevented by consumption of antioxidant-containing plant-based foods. See Chapter 4. For yet another organ and another disease, we see opposing effects, in this case on stone formation, by animal and plant-based foods. Incidence of kidney stones has been rising quite rapidly. As of 2012, 10.6% of men and 7.1% of women in the U.S. had developed kidney stones, a 70% increase since 1994. Not surprisingly, increasing fluid intake, that is, water, helps to reduce kidney stone formation. And high animal protein intake is still being documented as one of the most significant causes of kidney stone formation. Eye problems. People who can see well often take vision for granted. We treat our eyes more as little bits of technology than as living parts of the body, and are all too willing to believe that lasers are the best course of action for maintaining healthy eyes. But during the past couple of decades, research has shown that these bits of technology are actually greatly affected by the foods we eat. Our breakfasts, lunches, and dinners have a particular effect on 2 common eye diseases, cataracts and macular degeneration, diseases that afflict millions of older Americans. Yes, that's right. I'm about to tell you that if you eat animal foods instead of plant foods, you just might go blind. Macular degeneration is the leading cause of irreversible blindness among people over age 65. Over 1.6 million Americans suffer from this disease, many of whom become blind. As the name implies, this condition involves destruction of the macula, which is the biochemical intersection in the eye, where the energy of the light coming in is transformed into a nerve signal. The macula occupies center stage, so to speak, and it must be functional for sight to occur. Around the macula, there are fatty acids that can react with incoming light to produce a low level of highly reactive free radicals. These free radicals, see Chapter 4, can destroy or degenerate neighboring tissue, including the macula. But fortunately for us, free radical damage can be repressed thanks to the antioxidants in vegetables and fruits. Two studies, each involving a team of experienced researchers at prestigious institutions, provide compelling evidence that food can protect against macular degeneration. Both studies were published 2 decades ago. One evaluated diet, and the other assessed nutrients in blood. The findings of these 2 studies suggested that as much as 70% to 88% of blindness caused by macular degeneration could be prevented if the right foods are eaten. The study on dietary intakes compared 356 individuals 55 to 80 years of age who were diagnosed with advanced macular degeneration cases with 520 individuals with other eye diseases controls. 5 ophthalmology medical centers collaborated on the study. Researchers found that a higher intake of total carotenoids was associated with a lower frequency of macular degeneration. Carotenoids are a group of antioxidants found in the colored parts of fruits and vegetables. When carotenoid intakes were ranked, those individuals who consumed the most had 43% less disease than those who consumed the least. Not surprisingly, 5 out of 6 plant-based foods measured also were associated with lower rates of macular degeneration. Broccoli, carrots, spinach or collard greens, winter squash, and sweet potato. Spinach or collard greens conferred the most protection. There was 88% less disease for people who ate these greens 5 or more times per week when compared with people who consumed these greens less than once per month. The only food group not showing a preventative effect was the cabbage, cauliflower, Brussels sprout group, which sports the least color of the 6 food groups. These researchers also looked at the potential protection from disease as a result of the consumption of 5 of the individual carotenoids consumed in these foods. All but 1 of these 5 showed a highly significant protective effect, especially the carotenoids found in the dark green leafy vegetables. In contrast, supplements of a few vitamins, including retinol, preformed vitamin A, vitamin C, and vitamin E showed little or no beneficial effects. Yet again, we see that while supplements may give great wealth to supplement manufacturers, they will not give great health to you and me. When all was said and done, this study found that macular degeneration risk could be reduced by as much as 88% simply by eating the right foods. At this point, you may be wondering, where can I get some of those carotenoids? Green leafy vegetables, carrots, and citrus fruits are all good sources. Herein lies a problem, however. Among the hundreds, maybe thousands, of antioxidant carotenoids in these foods, only a dozen or so have been studied in relation to their biological effects. The abilities of these chemicals to scavenge and reduce free radical damage are well established, but the activities of the individual carotenoids vary enormously depending on dietary and lifestyle conditions. Such variations make it virtually impossible to predict their individual activities, either good or bad. The logic of using them as supplements is much too particular and superficial. It ignores the dynamic of nature. It's much safer to consume these carotenoids in their natural context, in highly colored fruits and vegetables. The second study compared a total of 421 macular degeneration patients, cases, with 615 controls. 5 of the leading clinical centers specializing in eye diseases and their researchers participated in this study. The researchers measured the levels of antioxidants in the blood rather than the antioxidants consumed. 4 kinds of antioxidants were measured: carotenoids, vitamin C, selenium, and vitamin E. Except for selenium, each of these nutrient groups was associated with fewer cases of macular degeneration, although only the carotenoids showed statistically significant results. Risk of macular degeneration was reduced by 2/3 for those people with the highest levels of carotenoids in their blood when compared with the low carotenoid group. This reduction of about 65-70% in this study is similar to the reduction of upwards of 88% in the first study. These two studies consistently demonstrated the benefits of antioxidant carotenoids consumed as food. Given experimental limitations, we can only approximate the proportion of macular degeneration caused by poor dietary habits, and we cannot know which antioxidants are involved. What we can say, however, is that eating antioxidant-containing foods, especially those containing the carotenoids, may prevent macular degeneration. This in itself is a remarkable statement. Cataracts are slightly less serious than macular degeneration because there are effective surgical options available to restore vision loss caused by this disease. But when you look at the numbers, cataracts are a much larger burden on our society. By the age of 80, half of all Americans will have cataracts. Currently, there are 20 million Americans age 40 and older with the disease. Cataract formation involves the clouding of the eye lens. Corrective surgery involves removing the cloudy lens and replacing it with an artificial lens. The development of the opaque condition, like the degeneration of the macula and so many other disease conditions in our body, is closely associated with the damage created by an excess of reactive free radicals. Once again, it is reasonable to assume that eating antioxidant-containing foods should be helpful. Starting in 1988, researchers in Wisconsin began to study eye health and dietary intakes in over 1,300 people. 10 years later, they published a report on their findings. The people who consumed the most lutein, a specific type of antioxidant, had 1/2 the rate of cataracts as the people who consumed the least lutein. Lutein is an interesting chemical because in addition to being readily available in spinach, along with other dark leafy green vegetables, it also is an integral part of the lens tissue itself. Similarly, those who consumed the most spinach had 40% fewer cataracts. In 2014, Chinese scientists reported that consumption of lutein and another antioxidant found in high quantities in green leafy vegetables, zeaxanthin, significantly improved macular degeneration. This can only be considered preliminary, but it suggests an ability of antioxidants to help prevent progression of this difficult disease. These two eye conditions, macular degeneration and cataracts, both occur when we fail to consume enough of the highly colored green and leafy vegetables. In both cases, excess free radicals, increased by animal-based foods and decreased by plant-based foods, are likely to be responsible for these conditions. Mind-altering diets. By the time the first edition of this book hit the shelves 10 years ago, I was 70 years old. At the last writing, I had recently attended my high school's 50th reunion, where I learned that many of my classmates had died. I was already receiving the AARP magazine, getting discounts on various products for being advanced in age, and receiving Social Security checks every month. Some euphemists might have called me a mature adult. I just say old. What does it mean to be old? At 70, I ran every morning, sometimes 6 or more miles a day. Today, at 82, I am still exercising daily, running or walking 3 to 5 miles a day, golfing in the summer or cross-country skiing in the winter. I still have an active work life, perhaps more active than ever. I still enjoy all the same leisure activities, whether visiting grandchildren, dining with friends, gardening, traveling, golfing, lecturing, or making outdoor improvements like building fences or tinkering with this or that as I used to do on the farm. Some things have changed, though. Clearly, there is a difference between the 82-year-old me and the 20-year-old me. I am slower, not as strong, work fewer hours every day, and am prone to taking naps more frequently than I used to. We all know that growing old brings with it diminished capacities compared with our younger days. But there is good science to show that thinking clearly, well into our later years, is not something we need to give up. Memory loss, disorientation, and confusion are not inevitable parts of aging, but problems linked to that all-important lifestyle factor, diet. There is now good dietary information for the two chief conditions referring to mental decline. On the modest side, there is a condition called cognitive impairment, or cognitive dysfunction. This condition describes the declining ability to remember and think as well as one once was able to. It represents a continuum of disease, ranging from cases that only hint at declining abilities to those that are much more obvious and easily diagnosed. Then there are mental dysfunctions that become serious, even life-threatening. These are called dementia, of which there are two main types, vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Vascular dementia is primarily caused by multiple little strokes resulting from broken blood vessels in the brain. It is common for elderly people to have tiny, silent strokes in their later years. A stroke is considered silent if it goes undetected and undiagnosed. Each little stroke incapacitates part of the brain. The other type of dementia, Alzheimer's, occurs when a protein substance called beta-amyloid accumulates in critical areas of the brain as a plaque, rather like the cholesterol-laden plaque that builds up in cardiovascular diseases. Alzheimer's is surprisingly common. It is said that 1% of people at age 65 have evidence of Alzheimer's, a figure that doubles every 5 years thereafter. More than 5 million people are living with the disease, and a 500,000 people die each year because they have the disease. It's listed as the 6th leading cause of death in the U.S., By 2050, it is expected that there will be 14 million people with the disease. I suppose this is why we blandly accept senility as part of the aging process. It has been estimated that 10 to 12% of individuals with mild cognitive impairment progress to the more serious types of dementia, whereas only 1 to 2% of individuals without cognitive impairment acquire these diseases. This means that people with cognitive impairment have about a tenfold risk of Alzheimer's. Not only does cognitive impairment often lead to more serious dementia, it is also associated with cardiovascular disease, stroke, and adult-onset type 2 diabetes. All of these diseases cluster in the same populations, oftentimes in the same people. This clustering means that they share some of the same risk factors. Hypertension, high blood pressure, is one factor. Another is high blood cholesterol. Both of these, of course, can be controlled by diet. A third risk factor is the amount of those nasty free radicals, which wreak havoc on brain function in our later years. Because free radical damage is so important to the process of cognitive dysfunction and dementia, researchers believe that consuming dietary antioxidants can shield our brains from this damage, as in other diseases. Animal-based foods lack antioxidant shields and tend to activate free radical production and cell damage, while plant-based foods, with their abundant antioxidants, tend to prevent such damage. It's the same dietary cause and effect that we saw with macular degeneration. Of course, genes play a role, and specific genes have been identified that may increase the risk of cognitive decline. But environmental factors also play a key role, most probably the dominant one. Earlier, we reported that Japanese-American men living in Hawaii had a higher rate of Alzheimer's disease than Japanese living in Japan. Another study found that Native Africans had significantly lower rates of dementia and Alzheimer's than African Americans in Indiana. Both of these findings clearly support the idea that environment plays an important role in cognitive disorders. Worldwide, prevalence patterns of cognitive disorders appear to be similar to other Western diseases. Rates of Alzheimer's are low in less developed areas.